Good evening, everyone, and welcome again to Beyond the Matrix, the program that asks you to think outside the box of convention, and I think we're accomplishing that more than well in these weeks of sharing some of the most prominent cutting-edge minds to you on this program, and tonight is probably the apex of that category with Dr. Michio Kaku, who is a professor at New York City University. He's the co-founder of string field theory. He's written several books, which I've read, although they're pretty intense. Parallel Worlds, Beyond Einstein, the wonderful book Hyperspace, which I've talked to so many of you about, and his new book, which we'll also be talking about tonight, The Physics of the Impossible. So just before I bring him on, I want to thank you all for listening in again. I hope you've got, if you've got anyone that you want to help understand where science and spirit merge, get them on and let them enjoy and listen to wonderful Dr. Kaku share with us his insights into the multiverse. And with that, I want to remind you also that toward the end of the show, we will open this for questions for Dr. Kaku. So you can look on the website and get the telephone number for call-ins. There are some 800 numbers and some regular long-distance numbers for those of you who are not within range of the toll-free numbers. Dr. Kaku, are you there?
I'm right here.
Thank you for being with us. This is such a thrill for me, as most of the people know who have worked with me and taken my courses. Your name is always recommended. Your books are all highly recommended, and it's a great, great honor for me to have you on tonight.
Well, thank you.
It's nighttime here. I'm in Italy, and I know it's still daytime where you are.
That's right. I'm in Manhattan right now.
Manhattan, okay. Well, I don't even know where to start, so I've got all of your books sitting in front of me. Talk about a wealth of knowledge. It's just great, and I've got an audience that is going to be also very interested in talking about hyperspace. So I thought we might want to move from some of the areas of your other books and then get into the new book, which is also very exciting. Is that okay with you?
Fine. And look, I just want to mention that Physics of the Impossible has now been on the New York Times bestseller list for 4 weeks in a row.
Oh, that's so fantastic.
Yeah, it's the number one science book in the United States right now.
Well, that doesn't surprise me, considering the incredible insights that you bring to a world where science, as I said, is merging with spirit. And I'm going to tell you how I found out about you.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching, I think, Discovery Channel a year or two ago, and I saw a program which I came in on at the middle, where you were showing how a woman was walking through a mall.
Mm-hmm.
And people kept walking into her, and she had no idea what was going on. Then they came to you, and you were in the middle of Manhattan, and you were explaining about other dimensions and how these people are actually walking in other dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to elaborate on that for the poor people that didn't catch that great show?
Okay, well, first of all, when I was a child growing up outside San Francisco, I used to spend hours watching the carp swimming in the Japanese tea garden. And I used to imagine myself being a fish, like the woman that you mentioned. And these fish swimming in a shallow pond live in a two-dimensional world. They can only go forward, backward, left, and right. But anyone who dared talk about the world of up, the world of the third dimension, the world of hyperspace, was considered a crackpot, an idiot. And then I imagined a scientist there, a scientist fish, who would say, bah. Humbug. There is no world of up. There's only what you can see. What you can see in the pond is what there is. So I imagine reaching down and grabbing the scientist fish, lifting the scientist fish into the world of up, the world of the third dimension, the world of hyperspace. What would he see? He would see a fantastic world where beings move without fins, a new law of physics. Beings breathing without water, a new law of biology. Well, today, believe it or not, we physicists believe, and we're trying to prove now, that we are the fish. we spent all our lives in three dimensions, moving forward, backwards, left, right, up, down. But anyone who dares talk about unseen worlds, worlds beyond what we can see and touch, is considered a crackpot.
That would be me, by the way.
But not anymore. The tide has turned rather dramatically. And now we physicists believe that perhaps we can, in fact, access or begin to think about higher dimensions, dimensions that we cannot see, dimensions that are all around us, just like the world of Up surrounds the fish.
Okay. So then would you, is that your theory then in hyperspace is just to help elucidate the many dimensions, the many layers of reality?
And
you talk about 10 dimensions. I'd like to know why you come to 10. Why do you limit yourself to 10?
Well, Einstein had a dream that he chased for 30 years of his life, and that was to create a theory of everything, an equation 1 inch long that would allow him to summarize all the forces of the universe and allow him to read the mind of God. However, whenever we try to combine the equations of gravity, the equations of light, the equations of radio, we find there's not enough room. In three dimensions, there's not enough room to cram all these forces together. However, if you assume there's a higher dimension, in fact, up to 10 dimensions, then all these forces simply simplify, beautifully, elegantly collapse into a single coherent theory. And that's what's exciting the world of physics. That Einstein didn't go far enough. Einstein stopped at the fourth dimension. But if you go to 6, 7, 8, all the way up to 10 dimensions, then you get a very simple, elegant description of these higher dimensional universes. So we now think that our universe is a soap bubble of some sort. We live on the skin of the soap bubble. We can't leave. We're stuck there like flies on flypaper. And our soap bubble is expanding. That fits all the data from our satellites. But we now believe there are other bubbles out there. And what are these bubbles floating in? What are these bubbles expanding into? If the universe is expanding, then what is it expanding into? We think that it is expanding in these higher dimensions. And for me, this is very pleasing because when I was growing up, I went to Sunday school. I learned about Genesis and the beginning of the universe. But my parents are Buddhists, who believe in nirvana, which is neither a beginning nor an end. Now we physicists believe that we can meld Buddhism with Judeo-Christian Genesis. We do believe that the universe was born in an explosion, but these big bangs happen all the time. They happen in a much larger ocean of nirvana, and we even have a name for nirvana now, that is 10-dimensional hyperspace. So we think that we have a beautiful picture of a multiverse. Universes being born, growing, expanding, with other universes being born, parallel worlds, and the larger arena that is eternal is nirvana, the nirvana of Buddhism, the nirvana of physics, 10-dimensional hyperspace.
So then what you're saying is that we can go with the concept of the all that is, that ever was, and ever will be, and that the Big Bang just comes a manifestation of the perennial existence of the all.
That's right. People have a hard time reconciling the Big Bang theory with some theology. But
yeah.
This larger picture, this picture of the multiverse, gives us a very beautiful and elegant unification of many of the paradigms of the past. And believe it or not, this is the picture that fits the satellite data. We have a satellite orbiting the Earth right now called the WMAP. It's given us the age of the universe, which is 13.7 billion years, and all the data fits this picture that we have bubbles, bubbling, like a bubble bath. Think of a bubble bath where bubbles pop into existence, expand,
mm-hmm.
bud, and baby bubbles, and bubbles collapsing into other bubbles. This is the new paradigm that's emerging from physics, and it's the paradigm that we've seen in religion throughout history.
How is that so? How does that correlate with religion?
In the sense that if you take a look at Genesis, chapter 1, verse 1, where it talks about an instant where God created the universe, right? That's consistent with the Big Bang Theory, and in fact, there was even an archbishop of the Catholic Church who said that the Big Bang Theory is compatible with Genesis. But then we have certain forms of Hinduism and Buddhism that say that there was no beginning. There is no end to this. It's timelessness. We have nirvana. And so now we have a melding of these two ideas, that Big Bangs happen within nirvana, that Big Bangs happen all the time, that even as we speak, universes have been born, and that our satellite data is consistent with this picture, eternal Big Bangs, eternal inflation. In fact, one of my friends, Alan Guth, may eventually win the Nobel Prize in Physics for this picture that seems to fit all the satellite data. So here I think we have a very nice blend of science coming from satellite data, theory coming from Einstein's unified field theory, and religious paradigms.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the wonderful things about your work is that you manage to make it understandable to the layman woman, and mm-hmm. that's why you're number one for sure on the New York bestseller list, which I'm really grateful for, because these are some pretty heady concepts, especially when you are so scientifically complete in your explanations. But you managed to do it, and that is really to your honor. So that said, can you give us an overview of you being the co-author of the string theory? What really is meant when you discuss the terminology of string theory and how that relates to quantum physics?
Okay, well, the Pythagoreans, 2,000 years ago, were Greek philosophers who analyzed the lyre string, and they said that there must be a mathematics of music, the mathematics of harmony. Why do we have sharps and flats and thirds and fifths and chords, and major and minor chords? And so using the Greek mathematics available to them 2,000 years ago, they were able to show that harmony obeys mathematical laws. Well, they were so stunned by this realization that they thought maybe the universe could be explained in the language of harmony. Well, they failed. They didn't have the theory of atoms. They didn't have chemistry. They didn't have physics. So that idea never went anywhere. However, now we've come full circle. Now we have too many particles. We have electrons, neutrinos, we have gamma rays, we have Higgs boson, Yang-Mills particles. When I got my PhD at the University of California, I had to memorize the names of hundreds, thousands of subatomic particles with very exotic names. How could nature be so simple if we had thousands of subatomic particles that we had to memorize, given by the quantum theory? Well, today we believe that all these particles can be summarized as nothing but musical notes on a vibrating rubber band. So if I had a microscope and I could peer into an electron, I would see that it's not a dot at all. That's the old picture, that the electron is a dot. But that it's nothing but a rubber band vibrating, and that if I change the vibrational frequency, it turns into a neutrino. If I change it again, it turns into a quark. I change the frequency again, it turns into all the hundreds of subatomic particles that I had to memorize to get my PhD in physics. So I would hope that in the future, when you get your PhD in physics, all you would have to do is say string theory, and you would get your PhD. Now,
you just manifest it.
Right. Now, we physicists therefore believe that physics is nothing but the harmonies of vibrating strings. Chemistry is the melodies you can play on these vibrating strings. The universe is a symphony of these vibrating strings. And therefore, what is the mind of God? Einstein spent the last 30 years of his life chasing after a theory which would allow him to, quote, read God's thoughts, read the mind of God. Well, now, believe it or not, we have a candidate for the mind of God. That's excited the world of physics. Time magazine, music magazine, all the major networks have devoted stories to this. The mind of God, we think, is cosmic music resonating through 11-dimensional hyperspace. That's what we think the mind of God is.
Well, this is why I'm so attracted to your work, because in my small contribution from the spiritual aspect, everything that I write about is about the music of the universe as well. And when I read it coming from you from a scientific perspective, I thought, oh boy, alhamdulillah, as the Egyptians say, we're really there. It's very exciting.
That's right. And next month, by the way, we are going to debut the biggest machine of science ever built outside Geneva, Switzerland, called the Large Hadron Collider. It is 17 miles in circumference. And we hope to actually create the higher musical particles that we cannot see because we are the lowest octave. Everything you see around us is little rubber bands vibrating in the lowest frequency. We hope to generate the next higher frequencies at the Large Hadron Collider. Now, the media, of course, has distorted the whole project. The media says that maybe you'll create black holes that can eat up the Earth. That's silly. That's a bunch of nonsense. We're not going to create any black holes in Geneva, Switzerland. That's silly. Okay. But what we hope to get is higher music. That's what this machine is all about. It's a
Okay, here's a question for you. How does this relate to the question of the music of the spheres?
Well, the music of the spheres was an attempt by musicians centuries ago to be able to explain the motion of the planets and the motion of objects we see around us and to explain motion in terms of music. Well, that idea never went anywhere because along comes Isaac Newton, who gives us the laws of motion, and that works very well with our space satellites and with the planets. And then along comes Einstein, who says, well, Newton didn't go far enough that the motion of the planets can be explained not just by gravity, but by space and time, the curvature of space and time. But now we realize, hey, Einstein didn't go far enough either. We have to go not just to space and time, but to hyperspace and to vibrating strings creating music
exactly.
resonating through hyperspace. And that takes us all the way back to the idea of the music of the spheres. So in some sense, we've gone full circle. We've gone full circle in terms of our philosophy.
So wouldn't it make sense then that if sound can... Okay, let me try to follow your thoughts through. With the rubber band concept of vibration altering the manifestation, then aren't we, of course, saying that if enough human beings on this planet raise the frequency of their thoughts, we can change the material essence of the planet?
Well, we physicists are not exactly sure how to change the frequency of these particles. One way to do it, of course, is with our machines that we have resonating next month at the Large Hadron Collider.
Oh, sure, this
another
is the
possibility,
music, no?
Yeah, another possibility is with satellites that we have orbiting the Earth. Oh, and by the way, I forgot to mention this. We now have baby pictures of the infant universe, baby pictures of the Big Bang. So one thing that people have always accused us physicists of is that we have no graphic proof that there was this explosion that took place 13.7 billion years ago. But now we have photographs of it, photographs of the explosion itself. The photographs were taken in the microwave region. If you go to NASA.gov, which is the website of NASA, you type in WMAP, and you can actually see photographs of the explosion itself. So this is really a gratifying proof of this basic picture. There was a genesis. There was a beginning. There was a moment when the universe suddenly exploded out in all its glory, and we now have photographed it. The next question is, what happened before this explosion? What happened before the explosion itself? And that's where we think string theory comes in. String theory actually takes you before the explosion. So time did not begin at the explosion which set off the universe 13.7 billion years ago. String theory predicts that there could be other universes. So if the multiverse looks like a bubble bath, then perhaps our soap bubble budded or sprouted from another soap bubble, just like soap bubbles will cut in half when you're taking a bubble bath. Or perhaps two bubbles slammed into each other to create a third bubble. That's called the Big Splat Theory. So the people it's called the Big Splat Theory.
Splat?
S-P-L-A-T.
I love it.
Right. So the physicists, my friends at Princeton, are pushing the Big Splat Theory. However, my friends at MIT are pushing the budding theory, that's called inflation, that our universe budded from another universe. We're taking bets right now. We don't know for sure which is correct. However, the point I'm emphasizing is that the universe and time did not begin at the Big Bang. We think we can go before the Big Bang, And we're going to actually measure this around 2014 when we send up a new generation of satellites that should give us a picture not just of the explosion, but a picture of the instant of creation when our universe was coming from the womb, and perhaps we'll even find evidence of an umbilical cord connecting our baby universe perhaps to a parent universe. That we haven't done yet, however. Everything else we have pretty much a good grasp on. We don't have proof of this, but we hope by 2014, when we send up the next generation of satellites, to detect the umbilical cord that connected our infant universe to a parent universe. So all this is pretty exciting stuff.
It really is exciting stuff, especially because it's so, it's so in tune with some of the most outlandish concepts that are coming out of the spiritual world. My books also talk about the astral cords of the sun. You're talking about the umbilical cord of the universe. It's just wonderful.
Right. And also, one of the themes that have come out of religion and spirituality is the idea of parallel worlds, that there are other planes of existence. The Catholic Church, for example, has long believed that heaven and hell represent different astral planes coexisting with our universe. Well, we physicists used to snicker at this idea, but we don't snicker anymore because all the evidence seems to point out that there could be other universes, other parallel universes. Now, think of a radio, for example, in your living room. Your radio picks up one frequency, and you know, however, that there are hundreds of unseen frequencies in your living room. There's Radio Moscow, there's Radio Havana, there's BBC.
Yep.
All these frequencies that you cannot hear. Now, why can't you hear them? You can't hear them because your radio is not in tune with these other frequencies. We say it is no longer coherent. That's the scientific term. It has decohered from BBC. You're listening to, you know, the rock radio station in America. You're not listening to BBC radio from London. You've decohered from BBC television. Well, now we believe that everything around us is vibrating. And it's vibrating at a certain frequency given by these strings. And these are called Schrodinger waves. So we have waves that are vibrating in your room. However, we also have other waves from other frequencies. Each frequency represents a different universe. So, for example, perhaps in your very living room, there are the wave function of dinosaurs, the wave function of a world where Elvis Presley is still alive, where Al Gore is president rather than George Bush being president.
Mm-hmm.
These are frequencies that we no longer interact with. We have decohered from them. This theory is called many worlds. It was proposed by a physicist at Princeton in the 1950s. People laughed at it when it was first proposed, but now we physicists tend to believe that Hugh Everett was right, that there really are these other worlds. We have decohered from them. We're no longer in frequency with them, but we coexist with them. So,
do you believe, Dr. Kaku, that some people are picking these frequencies up from other dimensions?
Well, I get stories from people who claim that. I don't know, because I would have to measure. I would have to, you know, measure whether or not these people are in tune. But if you look at the physics literature, we physicists no longer snicker at this idea. The idea of Hugh Everett, that is, many worlds, is now one of the dominant themes in theoretical physics. You can go to any physics library on the Earth, look up many worlds, and there you see it, hundreds of papers dealing with the quantum mechanics, the quantum theory of many worlds. Einstein didn't like it, but hey, you know, on this question, Einstein was wrong. Einstein didn't believe in the quantum theory, but we now believe that the quantum theory does describe the world. That's why we have laser beams. That's why we have transistors. Without the quantum theory, there are no radios. There are no television sets. There are no laser beams. There are no satellites. Everything depends upon the quantum theory. And the next extension of the quantum theory is many worlds.
Okay, I'm just going to interrupt for a moment just so that some latecomers need to know that we are talking with Dr. Michio Kaku. He's the co-author of The String Theory, one of the great physicists of our time, and he's here with us to discuss his new work Physics of the Impossible, which is on the New York Times bestseller list. And you're tuning in now. You're just catching us as we are discussing the complexities of the multidimensional universe. Not exactly lightweight fare. But taking it on a quick diversion, I read in one of the books where you talk about interdimensional lifeboat. Could you expand on that? I found that very exciting and interesting.
Okay, well, a lot of people come up to me and say, Professor, all this is nice. You know, you talk about higher dimensions, 10 dimensions, but how do I visit these other worlds? I mean, how do I go to these places, right? Well, that's difficult. First of all, religious people have talked about meditating and going between universes. We physicists are more practical. We would like to have a machine that would take us by pushing a button rather than taking some kind of hallucinogenic drug or meditating. And in my book, Parallel Worlds, my last book, I even give you a blueprint of what such a machine would look like. Now, you have to understand that Einstein said that space and time are like a fabric, and that time is like a river that can speed up and a river that can slow down, and it meanders its way throughout the universe. We measure this with our satellites all the time. The GPS system, for example, that you use in your rental car, the GPS system depends upon time speeding up and slowing down in outer space. But the new wrinkle is that the river of time can have whirlpools, and the river of time can perhaps fork into two rivers, in which case we cannot rule out the possibility of an interdimensional lifeboat. We cannot rule out the possibility of even a time machine that can take us between different rivers of time, different time streams. Now, this, of course, was always considered crackpot, but Einstein himself realized that time travel was possible in his own equations. In 1949, the very first time travel solution was discovered in Einstein's equations. Since then, we physicists have discovered hundreds of different kinds of time travel solutions, solutions that allow us to go between universes. And Stephen Hawking even calls them baby universes, little baby universes that allow us to go backwards in time or between different universes. Now, to be fair, the machine necessary to go between dimensions is huge. We're talking about a machine so big it has to be placed into outer space. But the very fact that we can even think about these things, I think, is quite amazing. Usually science fiction writers, fantasy writers talk about drifting through the river of time or our doorways to other universes. This is a sub-twilight zone. But now we physicists are taking this very seriously now and are even proposing blueprints for these kinds of machines.
Really?
Yeah,
when can we hope the science will achieve such a monumental success?
Well, it's not for us, in the sense that we are talking about huge amounts of energy. But one day, if somebody knocks on your door and claims to be your great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter, don't slam the door, because it is conceivable that your great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter lives in a time when time machines are possible and has decided to visit her illustrious ancestor. So don't necessarily slam the door if somebody claims to be a descendant of yours that doesn't exist yet.
Boy, Steven Spielberg will love it, that's for sure.
In fact, by the way, one of my friends, a physicist at Caltech, is even consulting for Steven Spielberg's next movie, which will be about time travel. So
Steven
Spielberg takes it very seriously. He actually consulted with the physicist to create his next movie, just the same way that Carl Sagan consulted with the physicist when he made the movie Contact. He actually used the latest physics to create the movie with Jodie Foster, the movie called Contact with Extraterrestrial Civilizations.
So when are you going to make a movie, Dr. Kaku?
Well, not for a while. I'm just shocked that I can even write a book that hits the New York Times bestseller list. I'm even shocked by that.
That's very exciting. I'm sure it won't be the last either.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you mentioned the website. I want to mention that again, www.nasa.gov.com.
Yeah, and also
it's a wonderful site. You've got all kinds of images of outer space.
Right, and also go to mkaku.org, mkaku.org. That's my website.
Oh, great.
Lots of stuff on my website. Articles about time travel, articles about higher dimensions, articles about what NASA is doing with this next generation of satellites. So mkaku, mkaku.org is the website.
That's fantastic. And I'm going to just name some of the most important books. Hyperspace, which you've got to have. Parallel Worlds, another wonderful book. And we're going to get to the new book, Physics of the Impossible, in a moment. But before we do, I wanted to jump back to what's going on in Switzerland. Can you tell us the date that that's going to occur?
Next month. Next month, outside Geneva, Switzerland, a machine that is 17 miles in circumference is going to be turned on. It's harmless. It's placed underground so that there's no radiation that comes out. And it is certainly incapable of creating a black hole that will eat up the Earth. I think the media really got carried away on that one.
But do you have a specific date that's going to happen? Because I know a lot of my listeners are going to want to try to tune into it psychically and see if they get a hit or a sense of it.
Well, we turn on the magnets next month, in May. We actually turn on the magnets. We get the beam going. It may take a little while to get the beam up to speed. And what the beam is going to do is to recreate a teeny-weeny, insy-bincy little piece of how the universe was created. And again, Mother Nature creates energies far beyond this, and nothing dangerous ever happens. The Earth gets bathed, by the way, in cosmic rays that are much more powerful than anything that we puny humans can create on the planet Earth. But we have created a machine which will give us a window on some of the dynamics of Genesis. And I'm excited by it because it may help to prove string theory. Some people say that string theory cannot be proven because you have to create a baby universe in the laboratory. And we're not gods. We cannot create a baby universe in a laboratory. Well, the next best thing you can do is to create higher levels of music. We hope to create what are called sparticles. Sparticles are superparticles. They are predicted by this little rubber band that vibrates in dimensions. And we are the lowest octave of this rubber band, but they're higher notes. We haven't seen them yet, and that's why we want the machine at CERN outside Geneva, Switzerland, to create some of these higher vibrations. So if that occurs, that'll send shockwaves throughout the world of physics. It'll help to quell the cynics who say that string theory cannot be tested because you cannot create baby universes in the laboratory. We can do something almost as good, which is to create sparticles, which we think are the next set of vibrations of a vibrating string.
This is very exciting. It's also very interesting that such a monumental endeavor is taking place just years before the famous 2012 transition. And I would love to ask you if you have any feelings or perception about what we're headed toward. People are really manifesting a lot of fear about 2012.
Well, let me say a few things. I've looked at some of the Mayan translations, and if you go into the calendar of the Mayans, they talk about cycles, and these cycles, of course, take place over thousands of years, and we're headed for the end of one cycle. But there are two ways you can look at it. One way you can look at it, of course, is perhaps we're at the end of a cycle, the end of the Earth. But the way the Mayans themselves, I think, looked at it was as a beginning. It is a cycle. It's a rebirth. So it does not necessarily mean the end of everything. It simply means the rebirth, a recycling, and that we've gone through previous cycles in the past, nothing happened, and we're going to go through more cycles into the future. So I look at it more as renewal rather than the end.
So do I. In fact, I look at it as an incredible archetype of our own process of reincarnation.
Yeah, so if we look at it, rather than look at it from the dark eyes of cynicism and depression, I think we should look at the universe as being glorious. I mean, it's absolutely amazing that the universe exists at all. It's a splendid, fantastic place that we live in. And it's very hard to believe that a cycle can end just all of a sudden, where most cycles represent rebirth. And that's why, if anything, I'm quite optimistic about the way the world is unfolding. The world, of course, is facing many challenges at the present time. But the human spirit, I think, is indomitable. And I think we will overcome these hardships. We've done it in the past, and I think we will do it in the future.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that, and I would like to add a big aho great spirit to that, because we need voices of positive thought and celebration of, despite all the darkness and difficulties on this planet right now, I agree wholeheartedly that the human spirit cannot be suppressed eternally,
and
that we are faced with challenges, and that's when we have our biggest growth,
mm-hmm.
when we overcome our challenges.
Right. And one thing that's actually good about looking at the world through cycles is that you get to look at the previous one, and you begin to think, well, where were we? What obstacles have we overcome in the past? And that is a guide for the future. So instead of seeing doom and gloom, I see areas where we can begin to reevaluate where we've been. Unless you understand where we've been, we don't understand where we're going to go. And the very fact that you know, looking at history through cycles forces us to reevaluate the past, I think gives us hope in terms of being able to forge ahead into the future.
So what do you think is around the corner for us? Let me interrupt you, because that's going to be a very vague question.
Well,
how do you foresee this transitional period ahead of us with all of the threat is there of so many dark things that we don't need to list them, and the hope is there for so many evolutionary leaps.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see the next few years playing out on this planet?
Well, I'll actually talk to you about how the next century may play out, because I do believe in renewal and rebirth, right?
Mm-hmm.
We physicists seriously look for evidence of intelligent life in the universe. Very seriously, and we also have to very seriously analyze the question, what will these civilizations look like once we make contact with them? For us, this is not an academic question. We have telescopes, we have satellites. One day we'll make contact. So some of us physicists have theorized that civilizations occur in three types, type 1, type 2, type 3. A type 1 civilization would be truly planetary. They have a planetary culture. They have mastered the weather. Hurricanes, earthquakes can be tamed. They have cities on the ocean. A planetary civilization is about maybe 100 years more advanced than us. Then we have type 2. A type 2 civilization has actually gone into the stars now, and they actually control stars, a few neighboring stars. They've colonized a few neighboring solar systems. They control the energy output of an entire star. And then we have type 3, which is galactic. They actually control the energy now of not just one star, not just 100, but billions of star systems. That's type 3. And if any civilization has ever visited us, they would be probably type 2 or type 3. Now, if you take a look at us, what are we on this scale? We are type 0. We get our...
And you just got finished saying you were very optimistic about...
Yeah, well, we have to be humble about where we are, but also optimistic about where we're going.
Okay, and so how do you define type 0, which is a little bit demoralizing?
Okay, let's talk about type 0. Type 0 gets its energy from dead plants. They still have the savagery of the forest. The savagery of sectarianism, ignorance, poverty, disease. They can only dream of being a planetary civilization. But if you get a calculator and just do the calculations, we are about 100 years away from being a planetary civilization. And I see the birth pangs of a type 1 civilization every time I read the newspaper. For example, what is the Internet? The Internet is the beginning of a type 1 telephone system. For the first time in history, we can actually see the outline of what a planetary telecommunications system would look like. The Internet is the baby, the germ, the seed of a type 1 telephone system. What language will they speak? They'll probably speak English. English is already the language of the elite. Everywhere I go to speak at conferences, the elite businessmen, politicians, and scientists all speak English. That'll be for the middle class 100 years from now. The middle class will all be speaking English as well as their local language. What is the European Union? The European Union is the beginning of a type 1 economy. And why do we even have the European Union? To compete with NAFTA, that is, the United States. So we're seeing the beginning of a type 1 economy. And everywhere I go, and I listen to the music, watch TV, I see the beginning of a type 1 culture. Young people love rock and roll, love rap, they dance to the latest beat. The elites have high fashion, which I think is pretty much uniform now throughout the world. We all love movies. That's also giving us a type 1 culture. So we see the beginning of a type 1 culture everywhere we go. But there's also a backlash, and this is what I'm afraid of. There are forces which don't want a type 1 planetary civilization because it's multicultural. It is enlightened. It is progressive. Believes in equality. Believes in progress in the future. These are the terrorists. Terrorists believe in a type minus one civilization, a civilization dominated by dogma, by rigid religious beliefs, by a very rigid hierarchy where males are at the top, women are at the bottom. That's the terrorists who don't believe in a progressive planetary type one civilization. So it's not clear that we're going to make the transition from type zero to type one. Some people think that maybe in 2012 we'll never make the transition to type one. But, you know, I tend to think of 2012 as nothing but a renewal, a new beginning. And where are we leading for? Where is this age of Aquarius that people have talked about? For me, that's a type one civilization. Planetary, tolerant, progressive, scientific, democratic. I think that's where we're headed unless we blow ourselves up.
Okay. Well, I would like to just add one thought to your elucidation of these differentiations of planetary levels and add that not necessarily only the so-called terrorists don't want, that might be a double negative, the evolution of our species. There are other forces at work besides the so-called terrorists, wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yeah. I would agree.
And I would like to just add that in there so that we don't typecast anyone.
Right. And also, of course, we have nuclear weapons. We have proliferation problems, chemical weapons, biological weapons, the greenhouse effect, global warming. We have many forces which may prevent us from becoming a planetary civilization. So I see it as a race against time. That's the paradigm that I see. On one hand, we have the forces of enlightenment, education, the forces that are creating a tolerant, multicultural, planetary civilization. On the other hand, we have the forces of militarism, sectarianism, fundamentalism, racism. We have the dark side of us that came out of the forest. We still have that old brain of ours that had to slug it out with everybody else in a swamp and in the forest. So we still have that with us. And it's not clear which one will win out. But I tend to think that overall, we will survive and we will make it past 2012 and we'll make it to a type 1 civilization. I'm optimistic.
I'm optimistic too. So that said, tell us a little bit about what is the overall significance and purpose of your book, The Physics of the Impossible, and how's that for a segue?
Okay, well, Arthur C. Clarke, who just passed away a few weeks ago, had a very famous statement. And that was that, quote, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Now, think about magic. Magic is being able to disappear, to become invisible, to reappear someplace else. Magic is the ability to turn objects into other objects and to disappear, reappear someplace else. Well, we're going to have much of these abilities in the coming years, like invisibility, for example. Many of your listeners may know this, but 2 years ago, we made a huge breakthrough in invisibility research at Duke University and also Imperial College in London. We were able to take an object and actually make it disappear, at least when you shine microwave radiation at it. At Caltech, just a few months ago, they showed that visible light can also act in the same way. And I think that in the coming decades, we will be able to take an object and make it invisible. So, Harry Potter, watch out.
Well, Isn't this similar to the famous Philadelphia experiment?
Well, in some sense, yes. In some sense, we now can be able to show that light can wrap around an object, reform at the other end, which we physicists once thought was impossible. You know, I teach optics to my students here at the university, and I always teach my students that invisibility is impossible because light, unlike water, cannot wrap around a boulder and reform at the other end like a river. Light cannot.
So how'd you do
this? Well, we did it. There's a new substance called metamaterials. It has lots of impurities in it, which we didn't think about before, but these impurities kick the light beam in a way such that they can wrap around an object. So take Harry Potter. Put him in a cylinder. Light that hits the cylinder wraps around the cylinder and then reforms at the other end. Proof of principle was demonstrated 2 years ago. This shocked the world of physics. Every single physics textbook is wrong on this question.
Now, but this is amazing. This is the physics of the impossible, right?
This is physics of the impossible, right. Now, another impossible thing is to disappear like a magician and reappear someplace else. We physicists call this teleportation. And at the atomic level, anyway, we've been able to do that in the laboratory. We've been able to make a particle of light disappear and have it reappear 100 miles away from one Canary Island to another Canary Island. That was done a few months ago. Next, we hope to do it to the space shuttle. We want to take a particle of light on the Earth, make it disappear, and have it reappear on the space shuttle. And after 2020, we have plans to do it to the moon. There's no limit to this. We can actually make an object reappear on the moon. Now, for atoms now, not just light, we've actually done it with cesium atoms and beryllium atoms. This has been done in the laboratory. And I suspect that within a decade or so, we should be able to make a molecule, maybe DNA, disappear, reappear someplace else, and maybe a virus, maybe a cell in the coming decades. Now, to do this with a human is not possible yet. I mean, let's be frank about this. A human consists of 50 trillion cells. We cannot teleport a whole cell yet, but we're getting there. And I think we have to think about the philosophical meaning of this. When you are teleported, you actually die. You disappear. You dissolve in the process, and then you reappear someplace else. Now, just like in this movies like Jumper and Star Trek. Now, if that happens, you've just seen Captain Kirk die in one chamber. And yet, here's this imposter Captain Kirk over there saying, I am the real Captain Kirk. I have his memories, his genes, his neural circuits, his personality quirks. And it makes you wonder about the soul. What happens to the soul if you just saw him dissolve and you just see him reappear someplace else with all his memories intact?
And that is the big question that I'm interested in.
We physicists are scratching our heads about this. I mean, what does it mean to be you if your atoms all dissolve, so you're no longer here? Whoever you were, you're gone. But then who's this other person over there who looks just like you, has exactly the same thought patterns as you, same memories, and claims that he is you? This is an academic question that in the coming decades, we scientists are going to have to deal with. Is there a soul? In the laboratory, we're going to face this question. So anyway, in the book Physics of the Impossible, I show that many of the technologies that you see in the movies, like Harry Potter or The Terminator or E.T., Star Wars, many of the Hollywood blockbusters, are in fact based on technologies that we physicists think that might be achievable in the future. And I give you a time frame, decades, centuries, years, millennia, before we can begin to attain some of these technologies.
Don't you think it'll be faster than that? I mean, just look at Star Trek with the little telephones.
Yeah, we have them already, right?
We have those already. I mean, they look exactly the same.
Right, and also look at telepathy. You know, telepathy used to be considered the backwash of fortune tellers and Las Vegas magicians. But we physicists have been able to actually duplicate limited forms of teleportation today. For example, at Brown University, they've taken stroke victims who are totally paralyzed, cannot interact with the outside world. They're like vegetables almost. We put a chip in their brain. Chip is about a quarter the size of a penny. I put a chip in their brain, connected the chip to a laptop computer, In 3 hours, you train these people to read email, to type, do crossword puzzles, and play video games and surf the web.
Oh, that's really spooky, Dr. Kaku.
Yeah, but you see, think of all the people who are vegetables trapped inside a paralyzed body, cannot do anything, and now they can email them.
Right, but let me interject. Think about all the healthy people they're going to get trapped inside a computer body.
Well, what happens is people in the future will have a choice. They'll have a choice. Some people may actually want to have a microscopic implant, and they'll be able to surf the web just by thinking about it. This is something that's well within the realm of possibility, just by thinking about it. Now,
but let's hope that they think a little bit beyond that and think about the significance of having a chip inside them and what that would imply and potentially the dangers inherent in such technology.
If you want to know something spooky, okay, here is something spooky now.
Uh-oh.
We can use MRI machines, brain scans, to look at the brain patterns of somebody telling a lie. When you tell a lie, it takes more energy than to tell the truth. To tell a lie, you have to know the truth, invent the cover-up, and then look at the consequences and consistency of the cover-up. That takes a lot of energy, and that's very easy to pick up on an MRI scan. So in the future, we may actually be able to see the outlines of thoughts, emotions, just by reading the MRI scan of a brain scan. This is going to go to court this year, by the way. There's an insurance company who denied the insurance claim of a person whose house burned down. The insurance company said, you burned that house down yourself, therefore we're not going to pay you a dime. This guy got very angry and said, I'm going to go to court, have my brain scanned in court, and I will prove I did not burn down my house. So in the future, this may definitely go to court. We may be able to solve crimes or whatever by reading the minds of potential criminals.
And you think this is going to take us to being a level one planet?
Well, it's coming. Certain things are coming whether we like it or not. And this book, Physics of the Impossible, tells you what is coming down the pike, whether you like it or not.
What important lesson do you want the reader to take away from reading this new, wonderful book?
Well, there are ethical questions raised, of course, because once you're able to, you know, zap people across the room, what happened to their soul? If you can read people's minds, what about privacy? I mean, don't we have privacy? Do we want people poking around in your thoughts, like in a science fiction novel? These are questions that we're going to have to confront. Also, however, I also talk about the possibility of starships in the coming decades. NASA is already beginning to think about what it would take to send a ship to the stars. In fact, I'm a consultant for NASA. I have to review some of these proposals for NASA to build a starship. This, of course, is decades away, not anytime soon. But we're looking into the possibility of making contact with alien civilizations in outer space. This is no longer just something for the movies. We scientists are looking at this very carefully. Also, Paul Allen, the Microsoft billionaire, donated $26 million to build a new array of telescopes, radio telescopes, to eavesdrop on conversations between alien civilizations. So this is big business now. Billionaires are beginning to pump money into this field, and some people are even making claims now that within 25 years, we make the first real contact with another intelligent civilization. Unless, of course,
Tell you that I think it's going to be before then, and maybe sometime in the future you'll remember this conversation, but I think it's going to be a lot sooner than 25 years.
It could be. It could very well be sooner.
All right, one more question for you, and unfortunately the time has just flown by because, of course, we could talk about whether there is time or not, but we won't get too philosophical here. The new book is Physics of the Impossible. We're talking with Dr. Michio Kaku, and the time is almost out. But I do want to ask you, what impossible invention would you love to see created? What do you think humanity needs the most?
Oh, what we need the most right now? I think we need a way in which we can solve all these ancient conflicts that have been with us since the dawn of humanity and find some equitable way. Most people, of course, would rather slice the pie thinner and thinner, more money for healthcare, less money for this, jockeying that takes place in the political arena. I would hope that we make the pie bigger. Instead of fighting for smaller and smaller pieces of the pie and getting into civil wars and invasions and stuff like that, I would hope that science and technology can give us a bigger pie so that we don't constantly engage in all these sectarian fights over slicing the pie thinner and thinner. But if I were to now think about a machine that would then really liberate us, perhaps one day we may be able to build a time machine to look into the future, in which case we may be able to see how things may play out and learn lessons from this and perhaps even one day change our own future. I personally don't
think
that.
But then wouldn't it sort of take the joy out of the discovery of it all?
Yes, but it would also take the agony and the suffering out of it as well. So there's a trade-off. There's a trade-off there.
Here's what I'd like to suggest. As you, in your incredible life and mind, explore ways to create the impossible, perhaps one of these machines that will come to us starts with your invention in Switzerland, where you raise, where you create a higher music, because I do believe that all of it, everything is music, and hopefully we will see a higher octave on this planet and throughout our space in the universe.
Yes, I would hope so. I would hope that that would fulfill Einstein's dream of being able to read the mind of God. And so I think we are now approaching some really cosmic questions that we can begin to solve right in our own backyards. And I think it's thrilling that we're going to be alive to see a lot of these questions being answered with our breakthroughs in technology. And hopefully string theory will guide us to this path.
And you are certainly one of our great leaders. I want to tell you, Dr. Kaku, that many times with friends we've talked about if you could have one dinner party where you could invite four of the greatest people on the planet, who would you like to have? And I've always named Michelangelo, past or future, Gorbachev, and I would love to include you in that list.
Okay, well,
so I hope in my lifetime I will be able to meet you in person and have another conversation with you, much longer.
Okay, well, one day I'll take you up on that.
That would be great. All right, I've been talking to Dr. Michio Kaku, leaving us all too soon with the clock ticking. His website is www.mkaku.org. He is the author of wonderful, wonderful books, and the new book on the New York Times bestseller list, Physics of the Impossible. Get it. Make sure it stays there. Tell your friends that we have a spiritual leader in the leadership of science as well. Thank you, Dr. Kaku.
My pleasure.
It's been a wonderful hour in my life. Okay, everybody, please don't miss next week. We've got Dr. Bob Curran on. He'll be talking about his book, Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms, which goes into sunken continents, vanished cities, the kingdoms that history misplaced. And please remember that after May 1st, I'll be switching the program to Thursdays at 12 p.m. Pacific time so that more of you can tune in. Thank you for listening. Please send me your comments if you enjoyed the show, and I'm going to try to get Dr. Kaku to come back. Again, my website, www.syrianrevelations.net, where we also talk about contact sooner than later. Thank you, everyone. I'll talk to you next week. Good night.